Good afternoon, Eastern Washington. This is Matt Shea, and welcome to Patriot Radio, broadcasting live from the capital of Free Washington, soon to be Liberty State, Spokane Valley. Brought to you once again by the committee to elect Matt Shea Republican in the legacy of Dr. Stan Monteith, bringing you the story behind the story and the news behind the news. And once again, it's not about right or left. It's about right and wrong. It's about our hope being in man. Nope. About being in Jesus Christ, without exception, our hope being in Jesus Christ. It's about not ending in prayer, but moving to action as well. It's about Ephesians 2:5-6, that God made us alive together with Christ and raised us up with him and seated us with him in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus. I want to talk today about something that we as Christians seem to avoid, and I don't know, it's interesting, it keeps coming up. Even Christian circles kind of trying to distance the Old Testament from Christianity, trying to say that the Old Testament maybe isn't applicable today. Or look at, there was no New Testament when Jesus was preaching the gospel. There was no New Testament when Paul was preaching the gospel. Those guys created it, inspired, of course, and used the Old Testament illustrations. In fact, Jesus himself said he used Old Testament to show where he was talked about in the Old Testament. And there's part of the Old Testament we gloss over, and it's the one that makes Christians feel the most uncomfortable, and that's the warrior side of the Israelites. But I have a question for everybody today. For men, you know, there's been this whole thing about toxic masculinity, right? Things are too masculine, there's too much testosterone. It's got to be bad. Huh? Being a man, that's what helped bring America into being. Being a man is what helped settle the West. Being a man's what helped us fight and win wars. Being a man is not a bad thing. It's something to be embraced. True masculinity is something to be embraced. That it's okay to do manly things. It's okay to go hunting and fishing. It's okay to go hiking with your brothers. It's okay to do manly things. Now, some people try to use that as an excuse to be libertine in their actions. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about the rugged, calm toughness, discipline, putting aside fear and moving forward. Humility, wisdom. And so for everybody out there today, I want you to take a moment and ponder this question. What was the ministry of David's mighty men? Now, for those of you that don't know who David's mighty men are, you can go to 2 Samuel 10. And there's a great list. In 10 through 12, and you can learn about what they did. Okay, but I want to focus on one part in particular. 2 Samuel 10:12 says this, because this was directly aimed at David's mighty men. Be strong, and let us show ourselves courageous for the sake of our people and for the cities of our God. And may the Lord do what is good in his sight. In other words, leave it up to the Lord. But our job is to fight for those things. And what were those things again? Be strong and let us show ourselves courageous for the sake of our people and for the cities of our God. Manliness That type of warrior spirit defending not just our families, our people, but also defending our cities, our state. Those are manly good things that we need to embrace again. And go read about David's mighty men. Read about what they did. Some of the just incredible exploits. And take a look at the list of mighty men and what those guys did. They weren't mighty because they were soft-spoken and erudite with a ton of college degrees on the wall. They weren't mighty men because, well, they took up a couple causes and marched. They weren't mighty men because they threw comments out on social media and called people names. That's not why these people were mighty men. It's not why God recognized them as mighty men. He recognized them for mighty men because they were warriors. Because they fought for not themselves, but for other people. They fought bravely. And if you get a chance, check out that list of mighty men in 2 Samuel. And specifically 2 Samuel 23:8. 2 Samuel 23:8, where the list of mighty men is. And the one I just read from was 2 Samuel 10:12. You can read chapter 8 forward and you get the idea, but That's what we need to talk about today. This idea that being a man is bad. And if you read this list, okay, the number one mighty man, the chief of the captains, Adino the Esnite, because of 800 slain by him at one time. 800! These weren't wimpy guys just sitting there, oh, yeah. This wimpy Christianity, this idea that Jesus was somehow a wimp, soft-spoken, and indeed, in some cases, he was soft-spoken, but in other cases, he was exactly what his title is, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And if he is our example, this idea that we shouldn't be warriors should be thrown out. We should be warriors. Absolutely. Up until and including learning how to physically defend our families and our people. And that gets to the core of the leftist argument against guns. It's an attack on masculinity. Really at its core. Because if you disarm the people, they can't fight back. And particularly, the mighty men can't fight back. Well, they'll figure out some way to do it. But much easier if you've got a sword. Understand where this stuff comes from. There is an image of God, Imago Dei, man is made in. And God is a warrior. Scripture says so. Jesus Christ is coming back as a warrior. Are we warriors? Are we mighty men? And men out there, if you're listening to this, I want you to just stop tonight, go read that stuff. Meditate on it. And reclaim your rightful place as a mighty man of God. And that brings us now to your daily intelligence briefing. On the international front from the Middle East, quote, and this is Pompeo talking now, Secretary of State, quote, we won't allow Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. Iran is aware of our resolve, end quote. So Secretary of State Pompeo drawing a line in the sand, no question about it. In addition to that, also coming from Deb Kefauver, a broad-based U.S. plan to fortify Israel's armed forces against a potential military showdown with Iran has just been approved by President Trump. This is exclusive from Deb Kefauver. So it looks like there is an arming going on, and it's not just putting U.S. military assets in Israel, but it's also giving Israel updated technology. So again, it looks like a war is in the offing in the Middle East, pointed toward Iran. Also on the international front, once again confirmed, now fact, nobody can argue it, that weapons under the Obama administration that were sent to Syria did in fact end up in the hands of Al-Qaeda. Fox News confirming that off a report that actually was done by InfoWars years ago. Nobody can argue it now. Just as we suspected in Korea, the peace talks are back on June 12th. So it was posturing as we suspected. Interesting, China's posturing now. And now Mexico trying to posture as well. What a lot of people don't know is that they're in the final stages of apparently negotiating some renegotiating actually trade agreements like NAFTA, etc. And it looks like Mexico's posturing by slapping a 20% tariff on U.S. apples. I find that a little ironic because it's a Democrat administration up here in Washington that's hurting. But any tariffs the U.S. slapped on Mexico would be even worse. But understand what's happening. It's posturing by Mexico because they're in the final stages of negotiations on these trade deals. Now, I want to stop there because these so-called free trade agreements, A, aren't free, B, aren't about trade, and C, really aren't an agreement between the peoples of those countries as such. Typically, these are negotiated by bureaucrats, and anywhere the government is involved, it can't really be free trade by definition, at least according to free market capitalists like myself. So we're going to keep our eyes on that and see what comes out, but know that you're going to probably see a new, I don't know what they're going to call it, but a new NAFTA agreement here in the next few weeks. And unless they have removed a massive amount of it, I suspect everybody listening to this show is going to be opposed to it. Because last time, NAFTA cost the United States tens of thousands of jobs. Also on the international front, Hungary chasing out Viktor Orban's administration, chasing out George Soros. And where does he go? Where does George Soros go? But of course, Berlin, Germany. Is that not ironic? Also, Tommy Robinson offered asylum, also by Germany. Now, that's kind of interesting. But Tommy Robinson still in jail in Great Britain for telling the truth. And after a secret trial, so to speak, and also his lawyer being one that he didn't want to have, in other words, court-appointed, he gets put in jail for a year. I don't think they understand what, doing that. I mean, it just emboldens folks when they do that, wakes people up. So that's what's happening. If you don't think that could happen in the United States, it's exactly where the left is going. I'm going to get to a couple things here in a second in that regard. But first, we're going to move to the national front and the Spygate scandal. The latest. So there were people saying, oh, they didn't do informants. And now people are trying to cut. Judge Napolitano was apparently backing the idea of putting informants in presidential campaigns. My goodness, you should never have government involved in presidential campaigns. Do we really want to go there? Where you have these third world dictatorships where whoever wins the election, and that's in quotes, then puts the other guy in jail. Do we really want to go there? And I think Rand Paul summed it up. The Obama administration, CIA, and FBI tried to illegally entrap Trump members. This is coming from InfoWars. And Rand Paul saying, you know, on an interview in Fox News, asking the question I just asked, and I totally agree with it. Do we really want the FBI and CIA involved in presidential campaigns? No, of course not. It's very interesting to me. They intentionally sent informants into the campaign. They paid money to get to London. Then they asked leading questions of people. That's entrapment, folks. And Trump, once again, being vindicated on the Spygate claims. Once again. And so I want everybody to understand something, too, that you've got to look out at the secondary and tertiary ramifications of different things and look out into the future. Because Snopes is not a source anymore. The SPLC is not a source, and we'll get to that here in a second. Things that they've lost all credibility. So let's talk next about the IT scandal for the Democrats. Now, I find this very interesting, but if you guys remember Imran Awan, the former IT aide to congressional Democrats, including former Democratic National Committee woman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, apparently is now prepared to make a plea deal with prosecutors, according to court filings. So Imran and his brother Abid allegedly ran a ghost employee scheme. And also, they were arrested on four counts of bank fraud after prosecutors said they tried to flee the country. And it's interesting because the indictments were only for the bank fraud, not the IT breach. But sources, and this is according to WorldNet Daily, are making it clear that the bank fraud charges were merely a way to get to the defendants. In other words, for the IT breach, the fact that they were feeding information directly from the Democrats to sources overseas. That's the allegation. Wow. And this idea of unauthorized access to House servers. So if there's a plea deal, you might see them roll on some people. So you might see some things happen here in the next couple of weeks on that scandal. Kind of was under the radar there for a while. Also on the national front, coming to us from Technocracy News. I mean, this really shouldn't surprise all of us, but Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Twitter all work with or consult the Southern Poverty Law Center in policing their platforms for hate speech or hate groups. And this was broken by the Daily Caller. Look, there are other options out there. I want to take a moment. If you're looking for other social media platforms, one is MeWe, M-E-W-E. Another one is Gab. There's a few more out there. But the fact of the matter is that the leftists are using a leftist shill, the Southern Poverty Law Center, to demonize half of America's population, conservatives. And this is the kind of thing that it's extremely dangerous, because what they're doing is they're saying what you believe, we now can censor you. And I really don't care what form that takes. They're doing it. And the smearing of people, I mean, they call Ben Carson an extremist, for goodness sakes. Remember that. The Southern Poverty Law Center has been hit so many darn times with fake news, false reporting, smearing. They've had to back off a lot from some of their assertions. You know, but they just throw these terms out there and just smear folks. And it's not right. It's just not right at all. Well, now you know that the big social media giants are in bed with them. All right, also on the national front. And I'm going to bring up Snopes, okay? Cuz this really okay, so there was a veteran group in Tucson, Arizona that has alleged that they found a child sex trafficking site, okay? Now allegedly it was on the property of someone who was a donor to the Clinton Foundation, okay? I'm not going to pay attention to that part of it. Snopes says that's false. All it was a homeless camp. Today, I received, just before the show, text messages and pictures from Arizona showing that they had discovered the body of what they're alleging is a child at this site. And that the sheriff's department is now on site. And I've seen the picture. In the picture of a skull. So there clearly is an investigation happening down there at this alleged child trafficking site. But Snopes just jumps out in front of all of them and says, oh, this has got to be false. Well, maybe there's more to it. I mean, if you're finding a body down there, we're going to keep our eyes on what happens with this as the facts come in and are confirmed. But Snopes clearly jumping the gun. And again, please don't use Snopes as a source. They've just lost all their credibility. Also on the national front, very intriguing, by the way, this story coming from InfoWars, that court documents, and I guess I should say shooting documents, and these are Las Vegas shooting documents, reveal that three women were found in Paddock's room. And these are recent documents released regarding the October 1st, 2017 Las Vegas shooting. And the fact that there were three women found in his room flies directly in the face of what the sheriff down there, Lombardo, briefed. So, you know, this is interesting. A lot of people just kind of saying, you know, things aren't adding up with this. But now this is really calling things into question. All right. Also want to talk about this Supreme Court case on the Bakers out of Colorado. First of all, great job for the lawyers, but it's not the big win everybody thinks it is. Okay. I'm not trying to take away from it. I mean, it is a win. But the case had more to do with process. In other words, the bias in the process of the Human Rights Commission down there and how they treated the baker than it did with the right of conscience, or the right of conscientious objection, the right not to participate in an activity based on sincerely held beliefs. And so the interesting part about this is many folks that I've talked to in the legal profession agree with that assessment, that this is not the big win. And now three judges in an Arizona court have announced that they are comfortable with the city of Phoenix forcing Christian artists to violate their faith and endorse same-sex marriage, essentially forcing them to go against their beliefs. This is coming to us from WorldNet Daily. So this is exactly what the implication of that case out of Colorado is. That now the agencies just have to look like they're impartial. Does that still mean that they can force people to do things against their conscience and participate in activities against their conscience? And it looks like the answer to that question, in Arizona anyway, is yes, and it needs to be resolved by the Supreme Court instead of sidestepping the issue. All right, we're going to move next to the regional front. A new report by the AHA Foundation that Washington State gets an F on female genital mutilation protections. I know that the legislature is going to be taking up some form of this in the next session. So keep your eyes on that. Also on the regional front, as we reported, what, a week and a half ago now, this is being picked up by News Channel 21 out of Oregon, that Trump may indeed pardon Dwight and Stephen Hammond. It's that close. So if you haven't signed the petition, go online and sign the petition to free the Hammonds. Also on the regional front, Pena out at Region 6 as the regional forester. That is a huge draining of the swamp. Also, the FBI agent, Joseph Astorita, is still on trial in regards to the Finicum case. And still haven't seen an update from that. When we get it, I'll tell you in the briefing. Lastly, on the local front, the Red Pill Expo coming up here in Spokane, June 21st through 23rd. Look forward to seeing everybody there. And if you know a young person who can prove that they are a student, have them contact me. We'll see if we can get them into the Red Pill Expo. So let's get some of our young folks to the event. And that is the briefing. Remember, the antidote to dependency and socialism is to be a God-fearing, self-reliant, freedom-loving American. Thank you to everybody that has been praying for us. And if you get a chance, go to Facebook.com/Patriot Radio US. Like the page, share it with your friends and family. And remember, this is a listener-supported show, and you can always go to VoteShea.com and support us. And lastly, if you miss Patriot Radio, you can always go to iTunes and Podbean. But we broadcast throughout all of Eastern Washington, North Idaho, and Northeast Oregon. But some of you are on the road, and especially you wonderful folks in the trucking industry, you can listen to it on iTunes and Podbean. It's just Matt Shea at Podbean. Well, it's my honor today to introduce my guest, who is the House Republican Minority Leader, J.T. Wilcox, from the 2nd District, all the way over near Yelm, Washington. J.T., thanks for joining me on Patriot Radio today. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing great, Matt, and thanks so much for having me on.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time. I know your travel schedule particularly has been pretty rough lately, but if you could, tell the listeners a little bit about what you're seeing as far as the legislative climate and what we can kind of expect coming up next year, and also where are we at as Republicans in Washington? Most people don't even know we're as close as we are to getting a majority.
Boy, well, I will start with that. Thanks for the question. You know, people think that Washington is deep blue, and maybe it is a little bit that way in statewide races, but when it comes to the legislature, we are about as closely tied as you can get. In fact, a couple of years ago, it was, as I recall, something like 74 Republicans, 74 Democrats, and then a Democrat who caucused with Senate Republicans. So that's about as close as you can possibly get. Now in the House, it's 50-48. We're at 48. That means that if we were able to take one seat net, we would have a tie, and we would have an absolute veto on everything that comes out of Seattle. If we pick up two seats, then we have a majority, and people like Matt Shea hold a gavel in a committee that really matters, like Judiciary, for example. And, you know, I think as far as next year goes, it really depends who's the speaker. If Frank Chop is the speaker, then I think you're going to see that Seattle agenda. And we've all been seeing what's going on there, a really anti-business, anti-liberty kind of agenda. People that are avowed socialists in charge and winning elections, which seems incredible to most of us that don't live in that environment. And I don't think most people in Seattle believe that either. I think that that has been taken over by politically by some really fringe people. And in some cases, there's a little bit of a mob mentality. And we don't want that to happen. What we would really like to see happen is for me to be speaker and people like Joel Kretz and Matt Shea to be senior leaders. And I think what you will see then is a lot of common sense legislation that looks at land use in a way that allows people to make a living and build a home, creates a economy in smaller cities and rural areas so that people can work closer to where they live, and something that looks at solving homelessness by building homes.
Well, you know, you said something, JT, if you were speaker, there would be a much different perspective instead of just focusing on one urban area of Washington State in regards to legislation, not just on one issue, but on all issues. Could you kind of tell the listeners a little bit about what your vision is in regards to that?
Well, you know, my vision is that the Republican Party and the Republicans in the Washington State House and Senate really represent the vast majority of the state. Over the years, as Democratic control has faltered, they have been isolated into Seattle, plus a tiny handful of downtown areas. Downtown Spokane's one of them, downtown Tacoma, downtown Vancouver. So they really only have the ability inside their caucus to think about the most urban parts of the state. Well, I am really grateful that we have these urban economic drivers, and I'm grateful that we have Seattle, which is a world-class economic hotspot. But I also know that there's a lot of life in Washington outside of those areas, and it's rural areas like where I live along the Nisqually River, but it's these thriving areas like the valley where you live. The suburbs, and we don't want to have policies that only appeal to urban people, whether it is economic policies or social issues where they're implementing their values instead of thinking about the values across broader Washington.
Well, JT, most people kind of recognize the name Wilcox. They go into Costco, they're probably eating your eggs. But you weren't this gigantic conglomerate. You were the normal average business, the great story of folks kind of raising themselves up. Tell the listeners a little bit about that and your passion for the small business community.
Well, thank you for giving me a chance to talk about that a little bit. My great-grandfather actually lived in Seattle. He had a small home on Queen Anne Hill. He traded it for the farm that I live on, and he came out there in 1909 with his family. And it was a subsistence farm for a long time, although he somehow put three daughters through college during the Depression. I wish he was alive so I could ask him how he did that. We have been in the egg and dairy business since then, and it's grown. At times, we were commodity processors for quite some time, and we've had our downturns, like almost every business that is generational in nature. I think in the four generations that have run our business now, every generation has almost lost it, and that's pretty common in farming and small business in general. And every generation has had to make the hard decisions that resulted in saving the business. And so we've sold off parts of our business in the past. We've had to close plants, and then we figured out how to be a value-added producer of eggs, and most of our eggs now are some level of value-add, whether it's further processed or organic, and I think that's the future of agriculture in Western Washington. We know that you're not going to be a low-cost producer in Washington, so we have to figure out how do we value-add, how do we add value that adds to our margin. And I know that every business faces these challenges. And businessmen also know that you have to make deals sometimes. And that's a painful lesson in politics. But we know that we've got to satisfy our customers. And that's a little bit like politics, too. We have a duty to represent the people that vote for us and the whole district that we represent. And if we don't do that, just like you can lose customers, you lose your voters, and pretty soon somebody else is representing your district.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about one of the issues that has been, you know, foremost on the minds of folks in Eastern Washington, and that is just the catastrophic wildfires that have been happening every year. We've talked quite a bit, and, you know, I know many folks in our caucus really appreciate the fact that you understand both Western and Eastern Washington, and it's not kind of a one-size-fits-all approach. Clearly, this is a big issue. What is your vision on how to solve some of these things? Because Republicans are always labeled, you know, as anti-environment, when in fact, I think we're probably the greatest conservationists that are out there.
Oh, you know, you're so right, Matt. And what a lot of people don't know is that some of the really effective bills out there maybe don't have your name on it, but you've been involved in the striking amendments that actually turn them from symbolic advances to you know, real measurable progress. What I think Republicans do in general is they reject the stuff that is purely symbolic, and they really like to do the stuff that is effective on the ground. And the wildfires are a pretty good example. By the way, I understand that they're going to be staging 3 helicopters in Western Washington this year for firefighting. We know that one of the major problems when it comes to the origin of these fires is the terrible forestry practices that the feds have employed. And I'm not sure that under Obama the feds really wanted to do forestry in the national forests, but even when they tried, they were getting sued by environmental extremist groups so that they couldn't do the harvest and the brush clearing that is necessary. The worst forests in the state generally are federal. The state has done somewhat better, but I've had discussions with Democrats in the House who write the budget. They didn't really want to fund the forest practices that were necessary to have a healthy forest. And so the state forests have suffered as well. Private forests generally are in great shape. We're lucky, honestly. I wish that more of Washington was in private hands, but we're lucky that big parts of it are owned by generational family companies that believe in preserving that forest for all of us for the long term. And part of that is doing the responsible harvest that means that you don't have all that fuel on the ground. I guess the last thing that we've learned over the last few disastrous years, and people like Joel Kretz and Tom Dent have been a big part of this, is local people know how to fight these fires. They have the equipment and the know-how to do it. But up until the last year or two, a lot of regulations kept them from getting out in the field and putting out fires when they're small. And because of a lot of Republican efforts and some Democrats that listened and learned, we've been able to empower some local efforts, too. But we need to do even more of that.
So here in Eastern Washington, we always talk about revitalizing the rural economy. But the fact of the matter is the Growth Management Act has really stifled not just the rural economy, but also our ability to build single family dwellings. Talk to the listeners a little bit about what that means and how big of a crisis it's really becoming. I know in this area, many people have already seen it, but it's not just here in Eastern Washington.
Yeah. Well, yes, we, you know, think of that as a urban problem, and it certainly has the greatest magnitude in urban areas. And a big part of it is because you just can't build an affordable home, whether it's an apartment building or a single family dwelling. Dory Monson recently shared some figures where I think it was something like $75,000 right off the top of a cost of a single family home were simply fees in King County. It's no surprise then that the average home is something like $700,000 in King County. Out in rural areas, I'm sure that your listeners know an awful lot about Hearst and the fact that Republicans in both the House and Senate stood up and said, even though it was painful, we're not going to allow some things to go forward unless we have a Hearst resolution that lets people drill these very low-volume wells on property that they already own and often, you know, had already planned, sometimes even had permitted homes. So having access to the water is a big deal. But I think, you know, in my rural part of Western Washington, it used to be really easy to have an affordable home on your own 5 acres. And because of GMA and increasing regulation and also this prejudice that people have against lower cost homes, it's become impossible, really, for you know, a lower income family to even hope to buy a home in a rural area, even if that's their dream, and sometimes even if they already own the property. So we're all about solving homelessness by addressing the cost of homes, and we know that a huge part of that is regulation, and there's no bigger regulation than GMA getting in the way.
It's interesting to me too that there are people on the other side of the aisle that have recognized the problems with GMA, whether that's the folks that are trying to get away from SeaTac Airport or the folks that are really concerned about, you know, school siting and where our schools are going to be built.
Yeah, you know, I don't think anybody's been talking about that longer and more effectively than you and David Taylor. And you've been voices in the wilderness for as long as I've been there. But it's absolutely right that over the last couple of years, there's been a few signs of progress. And the school siting bill that almost everyone in our caucus had sponsored at one time or another finally came through. And it was just crazy that there are, especially in Western Washington, but also in Eastern Washington, places where there's lots of kids already living, and because of GMA, they did not allow school districts to build schools close to where those kids lived. And so those kids who could have walked to school were forced to get on a bus and ride for half an hour or an hour to a school that was much more expensive to build, too, by the way. And that, in my mind, was one of the first kind of chinks in the armor of GMA. And I thought the people that ran that, you were instrumental. David Taylor was important. My seatmate, Andrew Barkas and Bob McCaslin actually was either prime sponsor or number two on the bill. I think they finally made the case that nobody could really stand up against, that we were inflicting unnecessary harm on rural kids and using up scarce education dollars with crazy regulations. And after a lot of effort, we got that through the House and the Senate. The governor vetoed the bill, as I recall, and then we ended up having to pass another bill, which he finally recognized. But even that common sense stuff was opposed by the hardcore fringe environmentalists. And I think in the long run, we're going to win this because the other side is unwilling in so many cases to just listen to common sense.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, it's a really good point that what happens in Seattle doesn't stay in Seattle. And so there are a lot of businesses that are moving and moving into places like Spokane Valley because they're sick and tired of the regulatory and tax burden. What is your vision for the state of Washington in that respect?
Well, I think Republicans have always stood up and said there is plenty of money coming in as a result of a strong economy and the generosity of the taxpayers. You know, as I recall, when we came to town for this last session, which was not supposed to be a budget year, we were up about 15% from the previous biennium, and that's a two-year cycle. 15% is a big, big raise, and we could have balanced the budget. We could have satisfied McCleary and done the other things that are necessary without asking for any more money. And actually, we could have rolled back the property tax increase that a lot of people are dealing with right now. And in fact, Kerry Condotta from the 12th District dropped a bill somewhere around day one that would have rolled back that property tax increase. And of course, we don't have the majority, so that bill didn't get a hearing. But it was absolutely possible to do all those things, give some money back to the taxpayer, and we would still have a huge budget increase likely for the next biennium because we still have a strongly growing economy. And so the people that say you can't have you know, good public facilities, you can't have good services, they're absolutely wrong. Anybody at home, any business could balance their budget with 15% increases, and the state of Washington can too.
So the McCleary case, at least at this point, looks like it's solved. I mean, the Supreme Court could move the goalposts again, but at this point, it looks like it's solved. What's next? It always seems like there's some big, gigantic problem or crisis that suddenly is created by some of the policies in downtown Seattle that we have to deal with, and it spreads throughout the state. What do you foresee as some issues that we're going to be facing here in the next legislative session like that to replace McCleary?
Well, yeah, and they did issue the order today, which essentially said that we are done with McCleary. That's great because McCleary created so much rigidity that it was really hard for anyone to be creative with the court breathing down our necks. And I think most Republicans agree that the majority of the budget should go to education. And in fact, when the Senate Republicans wrote the budget, it went from about 42% to about 50% of the state budget. So clearly, they and Republicans in general changed the priority that had been given to education over that time period. But I think that the other guys have a bunch of other stuff that they want to do. First of all, the Supreme Court continually intervenes in things that readjust our budget, sometimes in huge ways. And I know that you talk an awful lot about the fact that there should be a division of power and the court should not be legislating. And I totally agree with that. But until we can replace some of those justices, I think we're going to have to deal with that for a while. And that is especially a big issue in the world of mental health. And you and I have talked about mental health a lot. Republicans, I think, feel as strongly as anybody that we have to meet a constitutional obligation to provide for mental health. And I think we feel more strongly than others that we have to do that in an accountable way that actually produces the best possible results. I know that there's a strong movement on the part of Seattle legislators to bring some of the anti-business legislation forward at a statewide level, in part so that Seattle doesn't seem so uncompetitive. So I wouldn't be a bit surprised to see, although we're going to make an effort to preempt the job tax, I wouldn't be surprised to see people trying to make that statewide. I know that they are going to try to go statewide with their predictive scheduling, which is almost impossible for small restaurants and small service establishments that have unpredictable demands to deal with. And what that's going to do is just make it harder to employ people. It's going to put some businesses out, and others are going to more fully automate. And then you're going to see, I'm sure, pushes to accelerate the pace of minimum wage and whatever kind of socialist ideas Shama Sawant and her friends feel like rolling out.
You know, we've talked over here in Eastern Washington among ourselves about agency abuse and the way that they treat a lot of people and the fact that especially businesses seem to be guilty until proven innocent in a lot of scenarios and cases. What are some ideas that you would have on that issue, you know, in the future to reverse that back to innocent until proven guilty? And also, you know, you mentioned that, you know, over there, some of these ideas come out of downtown Seattle, and you're in pretty close proximity. But really, not only do they spread across the state, but these regulatory ideas sometimes get implemented by an agency without us even knowing about it through rulemaking. How would you see the Republicans handling some of these things differently in the future?
Well, first of all, I would say whether we have a majority or not, agencies are scared of representatives, and we've got a bunch of Republicans that are not afraid to take on agencies. And if some of your listeners are getting treated unfairly, they should call their representatives and their senators. And we can't change the law unilaterally, and we can't always reverse it. But it's surprising how often the fact that you've got a legislator asking the Department of L&I, for example, about an investigation, they will at least try to expedite that. So I would encourage people to understand that all legislators have a certain amount of influence. You know, I think one of the major reasons that we have this overreach on the part of the agencies is we've had single-party government for so long. We've had nothing but not only Western Washington governors for several generations, but everyone knows that we've had nothing but Democratic governors for something like 30 years. And what has happened is you've got a culture of people that know that they're not going to be accountable. Or if they are accountable, it's more for political reasons than for reasons of fairness or effectiveness. And the real answer is to elect a Republican governor from either side of the state. But, you know, I think there's also something that the legislative branch has really let down on. You know, we do have separation of powers, but the legislative branch is supposed to investigate agencies and excesses of the executive branch. And because the executive branch and the legislative branch have been pretty much controlled by the same party, there has been absolutely no investigation on the part of legislators into abuses by agencies. And I think if I could wave a magic wand and only have, you know, some level of influence for, 6 months, the two things that I would concentrate on is in the executive branch, I would love to have a really competent Republican governor do nothing but hire new agency heads and go as far down the agency as you can, because we would hire people that were competent and motivated to do the job and serve the interests of the public. And then when it comes to the legislative branch, if I could do one thing, I would love to wave a wand and have a committee that actually actively did oversight of the agencies. And that would make a big difference.
I absolutely agree. I think it would make a huge difference. And I think it would raise the confidence level of people all over the state of Washington. So they don't feel like they're looking over their shoulders, whether they're a rancher or a farmer, or whether they're a small business owner in a major city. I want to give you the opportunity to address the young people that listen to the show. We've got a lot of listeners that are of the millennial generation. What would be your message to them about maybe some misconceptions about Republicans and how they can be involved in making serious and good change for Washington State?
Well, first I'd like to say I think a lot of us, I don't mean Republicans, I mean people in our older generation, misunderstand millennials. I heard a very eloquent young millennial who was former military and is still in the Guard say, in response to somebody putting down millennials, and I know you weren't doing that, you were being very supportive, but he said, you know, I'm from the generation that watched the towers come down. We went to the desert for you. We lived through the Great Recession, and now you want to call us lazy. And I've got three kids that are millennials, and I couldn't be more proud of them, and I know a ton of their friends that are outstanding people and very public-spirited, successful in business, a lot of them, but determined to make a difference in the world. And doggone it, those are basic Republican values, I think. You know, Republicans want to be self-reliant. Republicans want to leave the earth a better place. Republicans want to build a legacy and leave it for their children. And, you know, I think that in general, Republicans really believe in the private economy, but they believe in that because that produces the greatest good for the greatest number. And we have also, I think, observed over and over in history that those that want to destroy the private economy, in the end, destroy the lives of all the people that they say that they're trying to help. And Republicans know that human nature doesn't change that much. The invisible hand of the market may not be always right in the moment, but in the long run does the best for all of the people. And I guess there's just one last thing that I'd like to share. I came into office during the Great Recession, and actually my first committee meetings, we had Occupy Olympia there almost in a state of riot. But we had really good hearings, and it became apparent to me right away that the people that are most dependent on government are people that have, for some reason, lost their family, lost their community, and they lost their faith and lost a connection to a church. And there are people that are successful without any of those things, but life is so much harder if you don't have those. And those are all institutions that Republicans have built in the past. And we want to bring those back. We want to have strong families. Most of us grew up in strong communities and know how they can take care of people in a way that's much more compassionate than government institutions. And of course, Republicans are almost always people of faith, and they respect other people of faith. That's what we offer to people, whether they're young or old.
I agree. That is what we offer to people young or old. And I think that that's what's drawing people to the Republican Party. And this so-called blue wave has crashed on the rocks. And I think there's kind of a red wave growing myself. But JT, I really appreciate you joining me today. If you could, where can people go to learn more about the House Republicans?
Well, we have two different websites. One of them, that's our legislative website, is, boy, I always Google it. I just Google Washington State House Republicans, and you get there. And it tells you an awful lot about what we're doing right now in the legislature. And then if you're more interested in campaigning, there is www.hroc.us. That's HROC.US, and that stands for the House Republican Organizing Committee, and that's our campaign arm.
JT Wilcox, House Republican Minority Leader, thank you very much for joining me on Patriot Radio today. Really appreciate you taking the time, and travel safe.
Thank you very much, Matt. And Matt, thanks for being part of our caucus.
All right, everybody, you heard that. And if you haven't ever heard of HROC, or you haven't, you don't know how to get a hold of, the House Republicans, or follow what's happening in the legislature, those are two great places to go. And a lot of times, it's very difficult to post things during the day or during the week when session's happening, because there's so much going on. And you can keep tabs on some of this stuff because there's actually staff members that update things. So it's a good resource to just at least know about. And also, I know that in campaign season that a lot of people have newsletters that you can sign up for as far as their campaigns are concerned. I do want to highlight something, too, that it's been interesting in the last couple of years. It's become very apparent inside the Republican Party, but particularly inside the leadership in the state house, that people want to see us do what we say we're going to do and get government out of the way and restore the presumption of innocence for business and restore the ideas of freedom and liberty and to restore choice and things like education and do budgeting in a way that people would normally do it for their household, where you're not outspending what you're bringing in. It is great to know that is now the prevailing idea and belief, that as compared to Washington, D.C., Washington State is taking a different tact. And the fact that we are two votes away from a majority in Washington State and we have seven ways to get there should be encouraging to all of you. In that this dress rehearsal the Democrats showed us of the socialist direction they want to take the state of Washington can just be left at that, a dress rehearsal, if we get involved. This is Matt Shea. Thank you very much for listening to me today on Patriot Radio. May God bless all of you, and may he make this generation the greatest one.